There, it's Jean Tiberio, and I'm a nutritionist and a wellness coach. Welcome to Healing Outside the Box. Today is episode 110, and I'm calling it The 411 on Food-Drug Interactions, Part 2, The Sugar Pills. And I also want to mention how diverse is our food choices here in Salem, which in my opinion makes living in this country a wonderful foodie experience. Now I imagine some of us might think, oh, here comes one of those Portlandia locally sourced organic food truck fanatics. Well, okay, but guess what? I choose to embrace my foodie elitist fanaticism. And in fact, yesterday I went out to visit a parade of highbrow foodie trucks, and I got me some of them damn dear good eatins. I'm talking about the International Food Truck Weekend on the Salem Common, which happens to be right outside my window. Now, this is October, here in what some people like to call the Witch City. And during the whole month of October, we have what's called haunted happenings. Now, most of these haunted happenings involve tourists who often stop me on the street to ask me where the witches are. And I usually ramble on about something like, well, actually, there were no witches, as it turned out. It may have been some type of food poisoning, perhaps from mushrooms or something growing wild in the area. And this foodborne illness may have caused hallucinogenic type symptoms, which at the time could only be described as being cursed by the devil. A similar thing was actually going on in Europe at the time. What really made it the hysteria that it was actually two prominent men on either side of the political fence decided to attack each other. Notice that one of the accused was a wealthy widow and decided to go around town encouraging their daughters and nieces to stop pointing fingers. Incredibly, only 19 people were actually killed, but I suppose you could also change your tone and say, 19 people were killed? Wasn't it obvious when they were taking these poor women's land that it was all about money and power? Well, apparently not, because in 1692, the famous witch hysteria is still very famous today. So anyway, I go on and on telling them the real story of the Salem witch hysteria, and their eyes glaze over, and then I say, well, the witches went that way, to which they say, oh, thank you so much, and then they wander off to find the witches. Salem, in fact, should be more famous for its historical role in the very first years of the colonies. Salem was a village in 1629, only 9 years after the Plymouth Rock landing. In the Salem Common, which I can see right outside this window, was an established meeting place for the Salem Militia, which of course became the colony's militia and the National Guard. That was back in 1636. And to put it in some perspective, the Salem Militia formed in 1636 with probably bayonets. I'm not sure they had muskets yet. And this was 140 years earlier than the first shots of the Revolutionary War in 1776. Actually, the birthplace of the American Navy was about a few miles north of here in Beverly. And from 1636 to 1776, quite a lot of history took place in Salem. The first two millionaires of the colonies were both Salem residents, not from Virginia, as I guess most people would assume. And the Revolutionary War almost started on February 26 of 1775, when the British military, led by Governor Gage, got tangled up in a bit of a brawl near North Bridge on Bay Road. But somebody retreated and all was well for another year. I'll give you a link to that in the show notes if you're interested in revolutionary history. Anyway, back to the haunted happenings on the Salem Common. So yesterday, I went out to the Salem Common and we met with about 10 to 12 international food trucks. These trucks had cool names like Plouf Plouf, and they had all natural organic ingredients and were grilling up seared scallops and some really cool looking Vietnamese food. They also had falafels, an Asian truck. It was all quite tempting, but I finally settled on the French truck, which had a lovely lump crab cake grilled over flames and topped with a lovely sauce. Ah, c'est magnifique. Anyway, let's get back to the topic of today, which is, wait for it, let's see if I can remember, a general review of the different diabetes meds and their possible food-related interactions. And again, I don't want to imply in any way that what I say here should be taken, I don't want to say seriously, but should be taken as gospel truth, because your doctor and your nurse practitioner and your pharmacist and your diabetes educator should have, or probably did, put together a total meal plan that takes all your meds into account. This is some background information in case you're curious about it. And as always, you can contact me on my website, healingoutsidethebox.com/contact. Just ask me any questions you'd like, and if I don't know the answer, I'll go looking for it. Now, first I thought I'd review the different types of diabetes. Type 1 diabetes, as I'm sure most of you know, is diagnosed earlier on in life and is considered to be an autoimmune disorder. This means that the pancreas wants to make insulin, but either the pancreas doesn't make enough, or the insulin that is made is attacked by our own bodies and is destroyed. The age where symptoms are discovered is generally childhood, but can be as young as 6 months of age, or as old as 11 or 12. The symptoms can occur suddenly and can be severe. These are extreme thirst, frequent urination, weight loss, lethargy, like can't get your head off the pillow kind of lethargy, and in the most severe cases, coma can result. These children's blood sugar levels can be well over 600. Generally, in these cases, insulin is started immediately, but a healthy diet and exercise is always encouraged to avoid those roller coaster blood sugar levels. The second type is type 2 diabetes and is much more common. Symptoms used to begin as people entered into their 40s and 50s, and they may have had a history of lower than average exercise rates or higher than average sugar intake. About 90% of these people were borderline obese or obese. As we all know now, type 2 diabetes is widespread and can occur in teenagers with similar lifestyle profiles. Stress can be a factor in this type, and by stress I mean psychological or physiological stress. In other words, type 2 diabetes can show up after someone has had a serious illness, such as pneumonia. Blood sugars can also spike after someone has been in a car accident and has had a head injury. And as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, many experts now agree that our modern diet, with its high fructose corn syrup and lots of simple sugars added to complex carbohydrates, the incidence of borderline or prediabetes and diabetes has gone way up. Most physicians now test everyone's blood sugar on pretty much a regular basis. If you've had a blood test, such as a Chem-13 or a Chem-20, the blood sugar test is in there. Prediabetes is a condition that is pretty obvious by its name. At this stage, your blood sugars generally spike after you've eaten a large meal, say at a restaurant or a party. They will also spike if you've had a sudden stress, such as a car accident or death of a family member, or again, something like pneumonia. With prediabetes, your blood sugar may also rise if you, say, have an intense argument with your significant other, or get caught in a long traffic jam while you're late for your appointment. This is because any kind of stress will result in a rise in your cortisol levels, and this will cause a rise in blood sugar because our bodies think we need to fight or take flight. With prediabetes, your sugars may return to normal once you calm down. So progressing to full-blown type 2 diabetes is not necessarily inevitable. And this is where a lot of nutritionists like to step in and take part, because diabetes is preventable. And I don't often like to say this, but as studies have shown, people can maintain a relatively stable blood sugar with weight loss, exercise, or stress management, such as something like mindfulness meditation. Again, no one has to eat perfectly or exercise every day. Sometimes you might not need to reduce your weight to a normal level. You might need to, say, lose 15 or 20 pounds, and you'll see those sugars return to normal levels. And that's because whatever you're doing to lose that 15 pounds is what's making a difference, in particular, the regular physical activity. But clearly, lowering portion sizes and doing some type of relaxation technique every day will help as well. Now, gestational diabetes runs in families and can occur during the second or third trimester of pregnancy. Most OBGYN physicians will test your blood sugar during what's called a glucose tolerance test, generally in the ballpark of 18 weeks gestation. Now, if a woman tests positive, her doctor will recommend daily blood sugar monitoring and moderate exercise, as well as a no-sugar-added diet. Your doctor understands that you may need to continue to gain weight, but will advise you to avoid candy, cookies, soda, juice, drinks, etc. And generally, your doctor will be pretty aggressive treating this because there is some risk to the baby if your blood sugar is even moderately high. Most people with gestational diabetes may have to go on insulin for the last trimester of the pregnancy. But then their blood sugars will generally return to normal after they give birth. At a later date, and it varies as to the number of years, about 50% of these women with gestational diabetes will develop type 2 diabetes. Now, let's look at the numbers. Most physicians like to look at the A1C level, and that is an easy way of saying glycosylated hemoglobin. It gives you an idea of how much glucose is in your blood on an average basis over the past, say, 90 days. An A1C less than 5.7 is normal. If you've got 5.7 to 6.4, that's considered prediabetes, and anything 6.5 or higher is diabetes. And I imagine your doctor will repeat these results to get a better idea what's going on. Now, in terms of the actual blood sugar, a fasting blood sugar of 100 or less is normal. 100 to 125 fasting would be considered prediabetes, and anything over that is diabetes. And this test will be repeated as well. Now, here we go again. Studies have shown that you can lower your risk of developing type 2 diabetes by half if you, say, lose 7% of your body weight, which is about 15 pounds if you weigh 200. If you engage in regular walking, say 30 minutes a day, 4 or 5 days a week, and if you cut down on your portion sizes and engage in some stress reduction technique. Now, let's talk about diabetes meds and any foods that might interact with them. I'm going to first go over the major types of blood sugar meds, because there are many, many of them. So I'll just touch on the few most common. The first are called sulfonylureas. These are the ones that I was familiar with back in the 80s. There's diabinase, there's glucotrol, and I believe micronase was around back then. These type of pills stimulate the beta cells of the pancreas to release more insulin. These drugs are generally taken before meals, and they're taken 1 or 2 times per day. Again, discuss all of this with your doctor or pharmacist if you're considering changing either from or to this group of sugar pills. Because this type of drug stimulates the release of insulin, it is possible to have low blood sugar on this, especially if you take the pill and then don't get around to eating for a while. Usually this side effect is not too severe, but it does still exist. As I mentioned in the previous podcast episode, alcohol and some of these diabetic pills do not mix, so ask your doctor about the specific pill you're taking. It's possible that this group of pills can interact with alcohol to cause vomiting, flushing, or general, as they used to say, malaise. Now there's another group of sugar pills that work in another way. The most famous of these, metformin, also called glucophage. It lowers blood sugar levels by decreasing the amount of glucose produced by the liver. It can also help lower the glucose in your blood by making muscle tissue more sensitive to insulin, so the glucose can be absorbed into your muscles. This one is usually taken with food, and it occasionally can cause some diarrhea. So if this happens, let your doctor know. Actually, I should also say that most doctors will recommend a high-fiber diet when you've got type 2 diabetes, because it may help slow down the absorption of simple sugars and carbohydrates, so you can avoid that roller coaster blood sugar effect. Now, there's a newer group of blood sugar drugs that also stimulate the beta cells of the pancreas to release insulin. And this group is best known by the one called Prandin. They are taken before each of 3 meals. Again, the recommendation is 3 equal meals, not too much, not too little. And with this type of drug, alcohol may interact with it. So if you like your drinks with a little umbrella and lots of sugary citrus liquids, you may want to run that by your doctor first. There's a group of drugs best known by the one called Avandia. These drugs help insulin work better in the muscle. They can also help limit the breakdown of storage glucose to free glucose that happens in the liver, so there'll be less glucose in your bloodstream coming from the liver. People that use this group of drugs are monitored closely for liver problems, which may first show up as an elevated liver function test. Now, if someone that takes glucose-lowering meds also has a history of heart disease, the doctor may not choose this group of meds to lower their blood sugar. Okay, like I said, there's other classes of glucose-lowering drugs that are used less frequently, and sometimes two drugs that work differently are used together. It's called oral combination therapy. And this all should be worked out, hopefully as a team, by your doctor, your nurse practitioner, your pharmacist, and your diabetes counselor. Now, in addition, you may want to ask your diabetes educator about maybe drug-herbal interactions or drug-nutrient interactions. And if they don't know the information, they can also look it up for you in books or various journal articles. Now, when these glucose-controlling drugs do interfere with foods, it's usually around the amount of the drug that is absorbed, or as we call it, available to our body. And most often, they only slow absorption, and not too seriously. And your doctor can let you know that if the drug that he is prescribing can lower your blood sugar too much, he will probably encourage you to take it with a meal or just before the meal. One food-related over-the-counter med that you may want to tell your doctor about are antacids if you happen to take them. They can reduce the absorption of your diabetes meds, but probably not to any serious extent. Again, it's always wise to let your doctor know. In general, when it comes to drug-drug interactions with these diabetes meds, there are a lot of possible interactions, and it's best to let your doctor or pharmacist handle this information. It goes without saying that managing your diabetes medications with your other medications, with your Super Bowl Sundays, in your weddings, in your winter flu bugs, is a tricky balancing act. It's always good to have a team approach. Your diet plan for management of your diabetes should be based on a one-on-one session with your diabetes educator and will be specific to your needs. But in general, all the common sense rules apply. If you reduce your fat and sugar calories, get a moderate amount of exercise, try a stress management technique, and keep an eye on your alcohol intake, you can stop the progression of diabetes-related side effects. Frequent blood sugar spikes can take a toll on all of your major organs and nerves throughout your body. But overall, blood sugar control can prevent all of those complications of diabetes. Perhaps another way of looking at it is to say to yourself, this is important to me, and maybe list the ways of how much better you'll feel and how proud your family will be when you lose the weight and control your blood sugars. So there's no getting around it. The plan to live a good, long, healthy life with less pain and more social activity, we need to do a little planning and make sacrifices to make it work. And whether we're talking about food or politics, if we enjoy what other cultures and others have to offer us, and we can choose what we like from those cultures and those people that make us happy, we all win. So I think you know what I'm about to say next. I ask you only that if or when you go to the voting booth on November 8th, vote with compassion and perhaps an appreciation for the positive things that others have to offer. That's all I have for you today. Be well and stay tuned next week for another episode of Healing Outside the Box.